The last, but certainly not least, of the panels of the day, it's the analyst panel. So I will kindly ask John Gaffney from Gibson Dunn to moderate the panel. We have with us a group of analysts who follow the market. They are very well known and respected by investors. So we're delighted to have them with us, so that they can share their view and outlook on the shipping markets. Thank you, John. I think we are looking for Fotis Giannakoulis and Mike Weber. Maybe they're outside. Let me go and fetch them.
Should we give them a minute, Nick? Nice you to make it. I think we're set to go. Hi, my name is John Gaffney. I'm a corporate partner at Gibson Dunn. My practice includes providing corporate finance, M&A, and restructuring advice to issuers and institutions across all sectors of the shipping industry. It's a real privilege to be able to moderate this excellent panel today. And I think in many ways it's a nice way to tie together a lot of the topics that have been discussed today, albeit with maybe a little bit more of a critical eye with the analysts that we have up here. Let me first introduce briefly who we have up here. Fotis Giannakoulis. Fotis is Vice President Shipping at Morgan Stanley. Fotis joined Morgan Stanley in 2010 and covers the global shipping industry. Prior to joining Morgan Stanley, Fotis was a banker at Fortis Bank and Potent Capital Services. Next, we have Herman. Herman is a partner and research analyst at RS Plateau and responsible for views on the shipping industry. Herman covers 35 shipping companies across all segments of the shipping industry, and prior to joining Plateau, Herman worked at SEB AB. Next, we have Michael. Mike is a senior analyst director of shipping, equipment leasing, and marine MLPs equity research at Wells Fargo Securities. Prior to rejoining Wells Fargo in 2010, Mike was a senior member of Deutsche Bank Securities Transportation Equity Research Team with responsibility for leading its shipping effort. And finally, Ben Nolan. Ben is director at Stifel Financial Corp. Ben joined Stifel in May 2013 and covers the shipping and offshore sectors. Before joining Stifel, Ben was with Knight Capital, covering the maritime sector, and before Knight at Jefferies as an equity research analyst covering the shipping sector. Maybe to start off the panel, the theme today of the forum has been positioning for the rebound. And maybe before we start talking about the different sectors and how well positioned they are for the rebound, I could ask each of you to take on one of the key sectors and sort of drill down a bit more to sort of level set us all on where these sectors stand, looking at particularly with a view to demand and supply dynamics and outlook, freight rates, scrap rates, asset values, and risk or catalysts that are faced by these industries. Maybe I'll hand one to each of you. Ben, could I ask you to start off with dry bulk?
Yeah. There we go. Absolutely. So on the dry bulk sector, I think obviously there's been a lot more optimism in the market as of late, really through the latter half of the year. In large part, as a function of the Capesize market, which all of you know had a reasonably good second half of the year. And I would say, with respect to investor sentiment, there still is a longer-term optimistic view, although maybe a bit more guarded in the near term. And that effectively is where my opinion lies as well. I think that if you look at the rally in the Capesize market in the second half of last year, it correlates exactly with a heavy building of Chinese iron ore inventories. There was a 25% build in iron ore inventories over the course of 4 months. At the same time, steel demand was down 5%. It was not necessarily a function of stronger underlying demand, but truly inventory building, and so subsequently, as soon as that inventory building had subsided, rates have come back down again. So I think, and there's still high levels of inventory today. Iron ore prices are still at $120 a ton, which I think is probably higher than the Chinese would like. And so I think there's a strong possibility that they are not really aggressive buying in the immediate term. However, there is in the next 3 years, well, by the end of 2016, there should be about 30% more iron ore on the water than with respect to sort of global dry bulk trade. So the global dry bulk trade should grow by about 30% because of new iron ore mining capacity alone, independently of coal or grain or any other commodities. So I think that longer term, there is good reason to be optimistic. And I think that those projects do move forward because of the high grades of ore that are produced from those mines relative to domestic Chinese production. But in the immediate term, I fully expect the Chinese to do as they've done in the past and seek to drive down iron ore pricing. And so subsequently, I think it could be a few months at least before we see a recovery in rates. And it's not simply a function of the Chinese New Year.
Great. Thank you. Botus, do you mind talking a little bit about product tankers?
Yes, thank you. Actually, we have seen that the year has not started very well for product tankers, and the product tanker market the last couple of months has been a disappointment, despite the high expectations. However, I want to point out that the disappointment mostly comes from expectations. And what we have seen the last year, that expectations, they have exceeded reality by far. A lot of people were projecting rates for $22,000, $23,000, $24,000, viewing the 2006 to 2008 levels as a potential target. And in reality, right now, we are talking about the spot market of $12,000 to $15,000, and probably a period market of around $15,000. However, still at these levels, the market is profitable. For a one-year time charter, earning $14,000-$15,000, that gives a good return. Not a phenomenal return, but an attractive return. And demand is growing, despite the fact that year over year rates have been down in January. The cargoes are growing, and we have seen that there is more volume coming from out of the U.S. Gulf. There is more production, more refining output out of the U.S. Gulf. And what it really depresses the market is the fact that the output from Europe is non-existing right now, and we have some lower output from the Middle East. Going forward, we think that the market will improve. The market, even versus a year ago, it should get a little bit better. But we do not expect any major improvement from last year levels. This is not something that we will jump from joy, and we do not expect double-digit returns for ship owners' investment. but this is still a healthy environment and much better than we were expecting a couple of years ago. I think, though, the biggest improvement in the market has already taken place. The U.S. exports, they might grow a little bit more, but it's not going to be major expansion of the volume. The Colonial Pipeline that comes online this year, it might also take away some seaborne volume. So the big bull story for those who are looking to find the bull story in the product tanker market should come from more volume from Asia, from particularly India, and potentially higher demand from Europe. But the global economy is improving. We should see some slight improvement in rates, a little bit of a tightening market. We need to be careful, though, with the order book because the fleet is growing by more than 5%.
Thank you. Herman, can you talk a little bit about crude tankers?
Yes, before I do that, I'd like to make a comment about the product market. You know, the key driver for the product market the last couple of years has been the U.S. exports. And at the moment, you have the coldest winter in the U.S. for 150 years. This means that domestic prices are going up, making domestic, making it more attractive to sell volumes domestically. And combined also with PADD 3, which is the U.S. Gulf refinery utilization of about 88%, which is quite low compared to 95%, which you've seen over the last couple of years. So we actually, on the product side, we're definitely not in the bull bracket, as Fotis mentioned, but we think that there is a good buying opportunity in the equity space at the moment, where people are surprised by the weak market rates. But when we speak to our ship brokers fixing cargoes in the spot market, they say it's virtually impossible to get cargoes out of the U.S. Gulf, which means that the Canadian and the U.S. East Coast vessels are ballasting back to the continent and pressing rates down there as well. So, you know, the bet in terms of the near-term improvement in product markets would be that as we get to summer, hopefully it'll get warmer, and you should see domestic prices coming down in the U.S., combined with the refinery turnarounds getting, completed, which should lift U.S. exports again and also recover of the product market. So that's on the product space. When it comes to the crude tankers, that's kind of been our thesis that 2012 was the year of product tankers, 2013 was the year of dry bulk tankers, and 2014, we think the sentiment change will be the biggest in the crude. So before we kind of talk about supply and demand, I think it's important to go back a couple of years and understand why did everyone get so extremely bearish on the crude market. As late as in Marine Money in June, you know, we had very intelligent shipping people saying that the crude market would never ever come back. And the thesis a couple of years ago was that, well, the U.S. is the biggest importer of crude, and the U.S. is now producing more themselves, which means that they're not going to have to import. So if the biggest driver on the demand side stops importing, then you're going to see negative ton-mile demand. And that's when people just said, you know, crude will never come back. Then if you look at what volumes have been displaced, if you go and look at the five biggest key suppliers to the U.S. in 2007, you see that Saudi and Venezuelan exports to the U.S. have remained quite stable. But West Africa, with Nigeria, Algeria, and Angola, exported 2 million barrels per day in 2007. That number in 2012 was 700,000 barrels. So it's strange to see that, you know, Saudi and Venezuela kept their exports to the U.S. stable, while West African exports were displaced. The reason for that is that shale oil production is light sweet crude. West African is light sweet crude. So clearly, if you can buy cheaper at home, you're not going to buy from West Africa anymore. Then the question becomes, what happened to the West African barrels? And the good thing is that this is not a cute story and a promise about the future. You can actually see on the fixing activity, West Africa US Gulf fixtures have dropped to the floor, while West Africa East has gone the complete opposite way. When you look at the distance, you can actually see that that's a longer distance. So unlike what a lot of people thought, that the U.S. would drive would result in negative ton-mile demand, we actually argue that the barrels that previously went to the U.S. is now heading to Asia. And we think that also explains, I mean, this became a lot easier now that you've seen 3-4 months of $40,000-$50,000 a day. I think people will have to go back to their models and try to explain how is it possible to see this rate volatility with negative demand growth and positive supply, and the end result will most likely be that, in fact, demand was negative. It was actually positive. And then when you look at the supply side going forward, you're looking at, we have official numbers next year of 0.9% fleet growth, and that's based on 2 million ton scrapping. It's about 6 VLCCs going through the fifth intermediate survey. All of those will be scrapped, and most likely you're going to have some slippage from deliveries. I mean, Rongsheng has half the Suezmax order book, and obviously there's going to be scrapping in other segments as well. So we think when people find out that when people start believing in the positive demand side and they look at the supply side most likely being negative next year, you compare that to a 20-year average rate level, you have an incredibly good upside potential in a lot of the names. So we're definitely very positive on the crude space, though one should highlight that we're not talking about anywhere near the levels that we saw in 2006, 7, and 8. We're just saying that this market will get back to a sustainable level. And with current asset prices and companies pricing in, call it a death of the crude market, we think there's a lot of upside when that sentiment changes.
Just one follow-up on that. Do you see with any change in the regulation around the exporting of crude for the U.S., which is sort of by appointment now, but do you see that opening up? Do you see the industry pushing for that? And
what would the impact be? Yeah, I think, you know, we look at the demand side in three ways, as volumes, distance, and productivity. So if you say that the U.S. exports will not have a volume impact, to make it simple, it would have a distance impact. So if those U.S. volumes head to Asia, that would be a longer distance than the average market, hence positive. If those volumes head to Europe, then it clearly wouldn't be a positive thing. Then you could also say that if you allow for U.S. exports, who will compensate on a one-by-one basis? If it's not compensated by one-by-one basis, it's going to also have a volume impact. So,
Let me add one thing on that, because, yes, U.S. exports obviously is going to help demand, but let's put things into perspective. How much U.S. exports will grow, and when is this going to happen? It's very unlikely that this year we're going to have any meaningful volume. Perhaps next year we might have 200,000 barrels. We have something like 38, 39 million barrels per day that is being exported by sea every year. So the impact of U.S. exports is not per se what is going to drive the market up. What is, of course, happening right now is that we see a very, very low fleet growth in the crude tanker market, but the numbers of demand, the growth of demand, are also very small numbers. If this exceeds a little bit, and especially if the trade flows changes, that has a major impact. The model is extremely, extremely sensitive. And what we saw the last few months, we saw in October, a lot of Saudi crude that was underpriced, it was sold to the U.S., and instead of vessels going to Asia, which they usually do, because the price of the Saudis were selling crude cheaper to the U.S. for a period of time, it tightened immediately the market. And we are in an environment with a very, very low supply growth. But when we are talking about VLCCs, 2, 3, 4 vessels, a very small number of vessels, they can completely change the balance. And what happens going forward, if U.S. Meets the targets that the IEA projects and keeps growing the domestic supply, and somebody has to balance the market, unless somebody says that the oil prices will collapse because of this oversupply, the additional volume that the North America is bringing, most likely, it's very likely that the Saudis will and the OPEC will cut production. Perhaps it might happen in April, May. What will be the impact of this lower seaborne volume on the trade? We are talking about an extremely sensitive and extremely volatile market. And this year, because of this tightness and because of the change of flows from a shorter haul to longer haul, yes, we might see big spikes. But three very few number of ships, they can completely change the balance. Just a slight change in the trading route to the normal, it might make the market collapse, and we need to keep it in mind. This is a volatile market. You need to be low levered. You need to be to have some cash flow reserves in order to be able to go through this volatile market.
Just to jump in here, and I'm not going to wait for my turn, but around crude and the idea that we're going to export from the U.S., that's a great topic, but that's a sentiment topic, all right? I mean, that's from a national security perspective, it's still very unlikely anytime soon. If it does happen, it's going to be on rail to Canada. And if it is seaborne, it's probably displacing Atlantic Basin cargoes to begin with. So to start baking that into a long-term supply-demand equation, you're just getting way ahead of yourself. We are positive on crude this year. I agree that this seems to be the year of crude, and while I would say 2015 seems to be the year of the container, it could end up being the back half of this year that the containers see a recovery. But the one thing I would say that, you know, while there is a lot of positive vibes around the crude space, and you do have a better managed order book, you know, a five-year-old VLCC in October costs $51 million. Today it's closer to 70, right? So the question is how much of that is baked in right now, and where are equity expectations? So, you know, when we look at bigger, more established crude companies, I think there's definitely a bid there in the equity markets. There's a dearth of high-quality crude carriers within the U.S. equity markets right now. You used to be able to look at Frontline or OSG and place your bets there. I think you'll see new entrants into those markets, and frankly, we so really need one. We need a couple, actually, big crude carrier plays within the U.S. But it's going to be a more gradual recovery, and I think our longer-term concerns are around the fact that the demand story there is not quite as robust as it is with products, and the product space can take a bit of over-ordering and still survive and potentially thrive. But we think that balance is a bit more delicate on the crude side, again, because while it's great to talk about expanding ton miles in the face of declining U.S. imports and a more reasonable order book, you still don't have that secular demand catalyst behind you like you do in some other spaces. So we're just keeping a very close eye on the crude space. On the dry bulk space, we're positive as well, but again, we're cautiously optimistic. I think the one mistake people tend to make when they talk about the dry bulk space is they talk about the replacement of Chinese domestic iron ore as one of the cruxes of a long-term bull thesis. While we are a believer in the replacement of Chinese domestic iron ore, we believe it's largely already happened. In 2000, and I think it was 2010, they relied on iron ore for 65% of their steel production. In 2012, it was 85%. Last year, as of the last time we ran the data, it was 113%, which implies the inventory build, I guess that Ben noted earlier. That's not to say it can't be a positive for the dry bulk space, but it's happening now, and it's largely already happened. So again, the order book there is going to be what we need to watch. On products, yeah, I think the Scorpio numbers this morning kind of speak for themselves. It seems like it's a great opportunity within the product space to see numbers like that in a period of traditional strength. I still like that space systemically. So we would look at this as a buying opportunity across the board. And then I'm pretty sure you're going to ask me about LNG.
I was going to ask you to touch on that.
Before you go there, Michael, I'd like to just...
You're on a roll, so...
I am on a roll. I had to sit quietly for a bit.
I'll just interrupt one. I just wanted to make it clear that the question was, what will the impact be, not whether...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
it
yeah.
Or not. So I totally agree with you for this. We don't think you're going to see any huge increase in U.S. exports of crude. But I think just to finalize the question on the crude market, I mean, if you think about it rationally, what do you need? We estimate that it costs $100 million to build a VLCC. So if you say that you leverage that up 60%, you have a 15-year repayment profile, which is quite aggressive, and you pay 5%, say you plan with 5% cost of interest or cost of debt, then you have a financing break-even of $20,000 a day. You have a $10,000 a day OPEX, and clearly you want some equity return on that $40 million equity check. So say 10%, you're at another $10,000 a day. What I'm saying is that, you know, fundamentally, I think you need to have I believe that rates on average will be at least $40,000 a day before you're going to see any massive amount of ordering, unless you get it below the cost, which I think has been the driver for all this ordering activity that you've seen recently. And by the way, interesting, the 20-year average rate on Vs are $43,000 a day, which is kind of making a bit of sense. So, I mean, you know, shipping is not going to be a flat market. It's all about timing the cycle and owning the ships when you're going up and not when you're going down. And we think that with negative supply growth in 15 and still very low supply growth in 16, you're looking at a period of 2.5 years where, on average, rates will go up. And clearly what happens in 17, 18, and 19, it's way too early to conclude on. But we think crude is definitely going to recover in the next couple of years, irrespective of U.S. exports.
We would agree. We just hope that you have your assets already, because secondhand values have already started to move.
Well, I would really briefly, on the U.S. exports of crude oil, last week spoke to a U.S. senator from a large oil-producing state. He said there has been no serious commentary on that whatsoever. So it's not even in the discussion at this point.
So let's crawl out of that rat hole that I took you down then. And could you just talk about LNG?
Yeah. No, I want to talk about LNG because I actually like LNG more than I like any other space in shipping. And I know that sounds funny considering we're about to hit the oh shit quarter for LNG rates. But let me just kind of back up and kind of paint to how we got here, right? So, you know, you see, I think owners saw the inflection point in global liquefaction capacity and coming in 2016, 2017, 2018. Granted, they thought that would be delayed a bit. We saw the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Rates went from, you know, mid to low cycle to peak at 160K a day. And you saw a number of owners say, screw it, we'll just start it, we'll buy now. This is a 25-year asset, and perhaps we can just ride this out and ride this directly into a longer-term secular catalyst. It certainly appears like the air pocket, which would be the time of, you know, the time and the rate environment between the Fukushima catalyst and the catalyst of just more liquefaction capacity, is very real, and this is the quarter that we are really going to feel it. We're going to see big listed LNG players, they're going to have new builds deliver and just sit there. And this is the quarter that everyone's going to see that. And we've all been talking about the LNG air pocket for probably a couple years now. This is the first quarter where it's going to be real. That said, when I look at the longer-term supply and demand dynamics within the LNG space, I prefer them to every other space I cover, and that's quite a few. That also includes LPG. And containers. I think when you look at what's on order today, and that's 115 to 120 vessels, that equates to the U.S. projects that have non-FTA approval and two more that are applying for FERC approval, which is extremely expensive. That ignores every other geography, that ignores Australia, and I realize the U.S. is cannibalizing some Australian projects, but I think there is a long-term demand catalyst here that is secular in nature, and that is very hard to come by within the shipping space. The barriers to entry are still very, very high. These assets are very expensive. And I think perhaps we will look back on this air pocket that's about to hit us as being the best thing that could have happened for the LNG space longer term, because, frankly, it's going to be very difficult to go out and buy an LNG carrier in the next year on spec with real rates that are at or near zero, and get any degree of financing, unless maybe you're Fredrickson and he's paying for that right now. So longer term, we think we move back to closer to kind of mid-cycle to peak level rates, and I know that's beyond this current air pocket. I would also say that at the end of the day, we're equity analysts, right? So we just cover the stocks that are out there. And when you look at the listed LNG names, you know, they're all diversifying into larger, high-spec, high-return, MLP-friendly assets. So they're looking at FSRUs, FLNG on Golar's part, or they're looking at long-term contracts. You know, the Yamal tender is about to come out, and TK shortlisted on that, along with Sovcomflot, which could be privatizing. These are very big, high-quality companies. They're not strategies that are playing a specific part of the cycle. These are companies, most of which that have access to cheap capital via MLPs. So one of the reasons why it's our favorite space is because you do have that quality component. And I can see that when I'm talking to clients, that it's a different set of clients that are talking, one, about MLPs, but two, around LNG. Generally, they're energy books, so they get the U.S. shale play. They're looking for derivative plays. They get the fact that we're going to hit a bit of an air pocket here. But they're looking for those systemic catalysts, and they're looking for GP value and companies that can diversify themselves through any sort of near-term weakness we're looking at for the next year and a half, and gain exposure to what should be lying behind that, which we think is still the biggest bull market within this space.
Thank you. Ben, how about containers? You see any opportunities there?
Yeah, and I won't belabor this, but I think it's possible that there could be some green shoots on the container side simply as a function of demand. You know, we saw demand growth of 4 to 5% last year. I think it's pretty likely that we'll come into those levels again, which, to be fair, is a bit of a departure from the historical average. Historically, the container demand growth had been highly correlated to U.S. GDP, much more so than any other measure, and there was a multiplier effect of about 3 times the U.S. GDP. That's broken down to closer like 2 times in the last few years. But to the extent that the U.S. economy grows 2 to 3%, it does spell out relatively solid demand growth. However, you still have an order book in the container side that's about 22% of the fleet and a really young average fleet age. It certainly has been depressed for a long time. Despite that, there's been a lot of orders, which is a little bit worrisome, but there appears to continue to be a really strong appetite by the liner companies to charter in assets, despite the fact that they're not making a whole lot of money with them. So, you know, hopefully it slows down in terms of the pace of new building orders and we can get to a little bit easier hurdle with respect to the supply side. But I would sort of as a last comment say strong demand growth overcomes an awful lot of supply issues. And so I do think we're trending towards a positive destination, but there may be a few hurdles before we get there.
I would just throw in that you know, the container space has been probably the most difficult space to call for the past 6 to 8 months because it's performed so well amid lackluster fundamentals from an equity perspective. And people are certainly waiting to play a rate of change thesis around a European containerized freight recovery that hasn't really developed yet. But I think what you're seeing, at least within the equity markets, is the development of a two-tier market where you look at valuations across the listed container ship players, and you look at the way C-SPAN trades and even Costamare to a degree versus Diana container ships or box ships, you really are developing MLP-like structures on the container side. In fact, C-SPAN was started as a synthetic MLP, and they get that kind of a bid. They're constantly going after new tonnage that's 10 to 12-year contracts. Now, how they manage the balance sheets there is going to end up being the kind of the key long-term caveat. But it is worth noting that there are names within the space that continue to prosper despite the fact that fundamentals have remained so weak, and that's because they're looked at as MLP-like dividend vehicles. Again, that would be C-SPAN and Costamare and perhaps a couple others once some cash sweeps end and some of the market opens up a bit.
Yeah, maybe we're running a little short on time. I can ask each of you to quickly, I'll just run down the line, comment on a couple things. I mean, beyond on investor interest in shipping, notwithstanding your view of where the fundamentals are, what sectors do you see investors focusing on, and what factors are they looking at?
I think
let's start with Fotis. We'll go right down.
Yeah, I think that definitely there's much more interest the last 3-4 months. The low interest rate environment in the U.S., coupled with the fact that vessels in most sectors they make positive returns, that has definitely shifted the attention. At the moment, I think that a lot of people are looking at the dry bulk market. They are following the dry bulk market. They might not be very excited about what is happening at the beginning of the year, but we see that the valuations of the stocks, they have stayed quite robust, which is pleasantly surprising for this time of the year with the BDI dropping that much. So I think that given the very low supply this year, and provided that the fears in about the steel market in China and all these rumors about letters of credit financing and the use of iron ore for as a way of financing for the steel mills and the traders does not prove to be true, we will see a renewed interest as the seasonality goes away, as the grain season picks up. Definitely there is more interest on the crude side. It was a little bit expected. The rates spiking took most of us out of a surprise. I'm not a big believer of this market. I think that there are a lot of circumstantial reasons why we had these spikes. We might see more spikes, but there is no fundamental story on the demand side, as Mike mentioned earlier. The disappointment has been on the product tanker market, and I think that people, they need to absorb a little bit the fact, not that the market is doing bad. I think that the market is balanced. I think that the market is in a good shape. But I think that the expectations, they went far too high, especially, a lot of investors, they wanted to believe nice stories. A lot of companies, they wanted to raise capital. A lot of managers, they wanted to make fees with other people's money. And that created a spiral of over-optimism that is being adjusting right now.
Thank you. I'm tempted to bet you that in a year from now you're going to come back and actually like the crude market. It takes some time to go from hate to love. I think in terms of what investors are focused on, it's quite simple. As my colleague said earlier, investors are interested in good risk-reward, whether that's in LNG, dry bulk, product tanker, crude tankers, even containers, whatever. If you can create a good platform, investors are definitely interested. I think that's, as you mentioned, the ship quarter is approaching, and Gaslog still managed to raise, $200 million. So investors are in general interested in shipping. They're not keen on taking on anything within a certain sector. It's all about digging down to the details. How do I protect my downside? And how do I capture the upside if you're right about the market? And whether you do that through operational exposure or financial exposure, investors seem to be quite, indifferent. And at the end of the day, I just think that the key point is in shipping, which is a cyclical industry. If you're both leveraged financially and operationally, you're just a ticking bomb. Obviously, if the market goes up, it's a nice bomb. And if it goes down, it's not a very nice bomb. But if you have a good platform, good assets, balanced risk-reward, I think investors are interested in any sector.
Just to add one more thing, and I certainly agree with what Herman mentioned, but I want to mention something that Mike mentioned earlier about the GPs and about the MLPs and how much interest there is today, regardless of what sector it is. I don't think that investors care at all if it is dry, container ships, whatever. They do care about some fundamental demand story that makes the growth prospects better, but what they like today is yield. You have a company that can pay a dividend, $1 dividend. I can tell you without even looking at the company what its sector is, what is the valuation range. There is a tremendous appetite for yield in an environment with a low rate environment. There's going to be a lot of demand. We see that companies that they have a sustainable yield with the growth, they can trade even at 5.5% dividend yield. GP structures with 20 to 30% growth, they can even trade at 2.5 to 3% yield. That's 35 times multiple. If you have a company with yield, there is definitely going to be a lot of appetite.
Maybe Mike and Ben, because we're running up against time, I wanted to follow up. But, you want to put some?
Yeah, no, just to continue on that theme around investors. I guess if Fody is divorced from crude and Herman is married to crude, I'm dating crude, but I'm going to kind of see where it goes. I'm not in a rush. around what investors care about, I think there's a pretty big bifurcation. I mean, you've got the energy books that certainly get, I mean, they get the shale plays, so they're going to look at derivatives there, and they're going to look for quality. And then you've got, you know, the emergence of GP and MLP investors into this space as they look out for, they're looking for cheap MLPs and cheap GPs. And the marine space has been on the periphery for a long time, but it's starting to become more core. So I think you're seeing a lot more interest around potential marine GPs and MLPs. That's why GasLog has performed so well. That's why TK has performed so well. But as Christina noted earlier, there are actually eight marine MLPs. I think she was leaving out Seadrill Partners because it's not really a shipping name, but it's, you're going to see, you know, 4 to 5 more MLPs probably within the next 12 to 24 months because there is a consistent bid there. But again, I think, you know, I would come back to, there is investor interest, but it's in quality. So I think there is certainly room for another quality company or two in the dry bulk space. There is certainly room within the crude space, and we definitely get inbound calls for people looking for decent crude exposure, and not just for strategies, but for legitimate companies with backgrounds and histories and something they feel comfortable taking to their boss and their PM and saying, hey, look, you know, they didn't put this fleet together, you know, last week. This is a company that's been around for a long time, and they think this is the right time to come public. And then on the container side, you know, it's pretty similar. You know, we also cover the container lessors, which are names like TAL and Textainer. They've been beat around quite a bit. It's a bit too early to call a bottom there, but there's a pretty consistent level of interest. So I would say primarily around the energy names and LPG. We didn't talk about that really at all today, but a lot of interest there. But again, it's focused on quality, whichever market you're in.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said there, and the last point that I would make is that I think the category of investors begun to change. A year ago at this time, when I would go meet with investors, it was almost exclusively credit-oriented hedge funds. Last week, I marketed 3 days in the Northeast and did not meet with a single credit-oriented hedge fund. They were all long-only, massive, long-term investment houses that you would all recognize, and my schedule was entirely full, and it has been a long time since there's been a broad-based concerted level of energy put into the sector from those type of investors. So I don't know if that's a bad sign or a good sign, but it is certainly happening.
Say we're running over, but there's one other question. I mean, Isabella mentioned today that there were 10 shipping companies who've either filed for IPOs or positioned themselves for IPOs, and this looks like a big year from that. There's probably a lot of private companies out in the audience right now. In 20 seconds or less, and we'll start with you, Ben, and come back down. What should those companies think about to best position themselves for a successful IPO in this market?
Well, I think at this point there are already and going to be a lot of candidates, so the more transparent that you can be, the cleaner the story, the better, and frankly also close to NAV. And I think at this point there's ample opportunity for people to invest in something so that they don't necessarily have to pay a premium to the value of the steel.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very difficult question across the entire shipping space, but certainly differentiation is going to be the biggest factor. And, you know, most markets, if they're not covered already, at least by one new entrant, you've got someone that's been sniffing around for a while, so getting a substantial premium could be difficult, not impossible in terms of premium to NAV. But again, you know, the two easiest ways we've seen to get a big premium to NAV have been to be the spot bellwether, or to be a marine MLP that gets 2 or 3 times. But it's differentiation in some way, shape, or form or another.
So, I mean, I have this delusional fantasy that you could potentially see consolidation in the shipping space. And clearly, it's probably never going to happen. But I think if you're a small shipping company without any, as Michael said, ability to differentiate, it makes a lot more sense to actually team up with some existing owner that could offer you, combine the bigger fleet. That would clearly be the best. But if you have a different angle, that makes you different, so you don't get the argument that you should be trading at discount to peers because of liquidity or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. then, I mean, if you have a good story, you have a good platform, there's definitely room for it. But otherwise, maybe think about consolidation, even though that's probably not going to happen.
I think cash flow matters. Immediate cash flows is a key, and the perception of growth that the story has to communicate. These are quite important. The other thing, I believe that some of these companies will make it, some of these companies might not make it. It can be luck, it can be the market might change. There might be three, four companies before in the pipeline. It is important for these companies not to take risks to buy assets that they cannot support anyway. We can afford to be wrong in our opinions. We write a report a few weeks later. We can write a report and we can change our view. The shipping companies cannot do that. They have to stick with their investment decisions.
Maybe we'll have to end it here unless there's a couple questions. We have a really good panel today. Here's your chance.
What time does the happy hour
start?
Sure,
please.
Well, we've got five major projects already, and you're starting to see FID on Australian projects delayed because U.S. projects already have a lot of infrastructure in place, so they have the chance to come in on time. Now, you know, Cheniere with us being passed has already come out and said they're not going to hit late 15, it's going to be early 16, which is more or less still on time. I don't think we're going to see a material slowing in U.S. export projects. I don't think everything that's been proposed is going to get approved. But then again, if half of what has been proposed gets approved, we're underbuilt by double, basically. And that excludes anything out of Australia or anything out of any other geography. So it's still going to be very lumpy because they're going to want to keep an eye on where domestic pricing is. But we haven't seen anything, and the government has not suggested anything that makes us think we're going to see a major slowdown in non-FTA approvals. FERC approval is the last process, but non-FTA approval is generally the most difficult to get. And then you're also looking at a number of Canadian approvals that are not quite as arduous that could augment that number as well, and that's excluded from what we've been discussing so far. So you've got a couple in Oregon that could get approved next. You've got Corpus Christi. You know, those alone would absorb the current order book and go beyond that, and that excludes, you know, Kitimat and everything else. It is.
What about LPG? How
do you see that? We like the LPG space quite a bit. In the U.S., there is not a built-out presence yet. You have smaller players in the U.S., so you've got Stealth Gas, which is more of a feeder trade, and which is a nice business, but it's very blocking and tackling oriented, and Navigator Gas, which is slightly bigger. But you still have the major long-haul players that are in Europe, so Dorian, Avance, and BW, we launched on all of them recently. We think it's too early to pick a winner. We do think there's going to be some consolidation in that space. So, you know, maybe it's not that big of a dream that we'll see some consolidation in the shipping space. But again, I think what you're going to see is someone emerge as the spot bellwether that has enough size to maybe not command pricing power, but to at least impact the market. And then you're going to see a couple companies that take more of a project-oriented approach, potentially look at spinning MLPs. I think the company that has the most traction with the U.S. export infrastructure complex is really Navigator, because they're already over there and they've got land in Marcus Hook. But Dorian is a name that looks at that longer term projects that could eventually maybe look down the MLP road. But it's still very, very early. We like the long-term dynamics there. I do think the demand dynamics longer term are still better on the LNG side. You tend to get more visibility. That's not as much of a – LNG is still an ARB-driven trade, but there are at least dedicated volumes there, and we don't quite have that yet in the LPG side. But we're positive on LPG in general.
I would just like to kind of follow up that question. I mean, if you look at U.S. export terminal capacity, and U.S. propane export almost doubled in 2013, and you can see the export terminal expansions in the U.S. Gulf going from about 12, 13 million tons now to up to 36 million tons by 2016. So it's very clear that, I mean, if you look at the arbitrage, as you said, there's high incentives for exporting propane, which is associated with gas production in the U.S. But when it comes to the LNG market, I mean, I definitely agree with your long-term thesis, but it's a bit like the famous quote by Keynes, that the market can stay rational for long and then you can stay solvent. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the LNG market, you know, you're going into a two-year period where it's not going to be a lot of volume growth.
Right. The one thing I would add to that, though, is that, you know, MR stocks started to work before MR rates started to move. And again, this is going to be the holy shit quarter for LNG. They stripped that out of my note because my compliance group thought that was inappropriate, but I can say it here because they're not in the room. It's going to be really ugly, and next quarter is probably going to be ugly as well from a rate perspective. There certainly will be unless the major companies find a way to diversify away from that. But no, I agree. It's going to be an ugly couple years. The question is that will the Golars of the world find ways to divert our attention towards longer-term, expensive, high-return projects that that could end up make them a lot more money in the long run.
I agree.
Great. Well, thank you. Oh, please.
The second-hand ships.
That 60% have what?
60-70% of the ships they go after. The competition they have is other private equity.
Well, he's on the front row, so I have no reason to doubt him. But I would tell you that I've done a whole lot of work with private equity in the last 3 years, and there's a lot of people with a lot of money left that are still very active and shopping for assets. So, you know, I'm not the one that's out there trying to win deals, but I can tell you I talk to a lot of people that are, and so 60% seems maybe even low.
Eventually they'll get to a point where they'll be willing to pay a premium that operators won't. We see that in the container leasing side a lot, where you get operators that just get priced out of the market almost right away because they'll go up against PE shops. They're willing to pay a turn or two higher than they will, and it's not even particularly close. So it depends on whether you're partnered with another PE fund. It gets very complicated, but it certainly seems accurate, and they would definitely be in a position to know. I think it certainly correlates. Yeah, I think that would explain a lot of the uptick in secondhand pricing.
Well, I'll answer that. I think that just because there may be a pool of capital that is causing asset prices to be a little bit higher than they may have otherwise been, it doesn't necessarily mean that asset prices are high, just higher than they may otherwise be. Longer term, if you look at discounted cash flows and depending on your outlook for the market, if in fact we do see rising rates, it's very likely that we could see asset values appreciate, even though maybe in a different market environment that level of appreciation would be greater if the capital was not already in place.
What Ben's talking about is pulling forward growth that would be coming anyway, and that couldn't be true in certain segments, but that's a very dangerous game to be playing. So your question about whether or not that can be applied to other segments, and it hasn't happened yet, sure, but it would depend on the segment, but we've already gone from product to dry bulk, to crude, and we've already talked about containers potentially catching a bid next year. So that's already happening, to answer your question.
Great. Well, before Nick gives me the hook here, I just want to thank each of you on this panel. I think we covered a lot of ground, very insightful, comprehensive conversation. Thank you very much. And if we give if this panel and I think also Capital Inc. a round of applause for a really fantastic forum.